handsomest man Felicity Faircloth had ever seen, did a double take, his gaze narrowing on her.
"There," Whit said. "A message was received. The gold frock was inspired."
It had been calculated to summon Ewan's attention, and his memories, to remind Ewan of a promise made long ago, one that he had never made good on, one that he would never make good on. The gold dress would send a message, all without Felicity Faircloth knowing, that Devil had been there first, that he was ahead of his brother in this game, that he would win. Marwick watched her for a long moment, and all Devil wanted to do was steal her away. He was saved from the instinct by a different man, the one who had touched her wrist earlier. He indicated the orchestra and extended his hand. An invitation to dance. Felicity put her hand in his, and he led her onto the dance floor, away from Ewan. Away from Devil. Whit grunted.
"I'm leaving." "Go, then," he said. "I'm staying."
"With her?"
"Yes."
"With them."
After a long silence, Whit said quietly,
"Good chase, then,"
and left Devil in the darkness, watching her as she was passed from partner to partner, spinning across the ballroom again and again. He watched as she smiled up at one escort after another, silently cataloguing each one's missteps, a hand too low on her waist, a too lingering glance at her bosom, a whisper too close to her ear. As he watched the performance, Devil began to ache with it, with the keen distaste for the men who are able to touch her, to hold her, to dance with her. And he quietly imagined punishing them, the way he'd punished Reggie the night before, banishing them from her presence. For a moment, he imagined what would happen if he could do that, if he could banish one after another, until the only man left was him. A man unworthy of her, as he fully intended to use her to ruin another before leaving her in ruin herself. But there had been a time, decades earlier, when it might have been Devil inside that room, dressed in finery, watching his betrothed clad in finely spun gold, happily pulling her into his arms and dancing her through the room. There had been a time when he might have been the Duke, when he might have been able to give Felicity Faircloth the life of which she dreamed. And for a fleeting moment, he wondered what he might have done to open that door, if he'd known she was on the other side. Anything. Blessedly, the dancing stopped, and she was alone at the edge of the ballroom, behind a potted fern, stepping through a door left open to the night beyond. The night where he reigned. Chapter 11. Felicity had spent much of her 27 years at the center of the Ton. She'd been born with immense privilege, the daughter of a rich marquis, sister of an even richer earl, cousin to dukes and viscounts. She'd been smiled upon by society, and when she came out, it was to be immediately welcomed by the most powerful children of the aristocracy. Women invited her to the gossip of ladies' salons, men scraped and bowed and battled their way to refreshment tables to fetch glasses of champagne. She'd never been belle of the ball, but she'd been belle of the ball adjacent, which meant dancing every dance and flirting with gentlemen and summoning the vaguest of pity for those who stood at the edge of the ballroom. And she'd never quite noticed what it was to be at the center of the ballroom, because she'd always been there. That is, until she was banished from it. Then, like an opium eater, all she'd wanted was to return. Devil had promised her that return, and somehow he'd delivered it, as though he were magic after all, as though he really could make the impossible possible. She'd arrived that evening in the gown he'd sent, which looked as though it were made of spun gold, and she'd been instantly surrounded by smiling, welcoming faces, each more complimentary than the last, each wishing to speak a kindness to her, to make her laugh, and all because her lie had somehow not been revealed. In their minds, she was the next Duchess of Marwick, infinitely more valuable that night than she had been a week earlier, and they welcomed her with open arms. But it was not as sweet a homecoming as Felicity had imagined, because she was no different than she had been a week earlier. And now, halfway through the ball, having danced a half dozen dances and flirted not at all effortlessly, having had trouble knowing when to laugh and when a laugh might be taken as a great insult, and having been terrified that she might say or do something wrong and ruin her one chance at saving her family, Felicity Faircloth knew the truth. Being a darling of the temps was a fireplace filled with wood left out in the rain, hopeful and worthless. All of London minced and simpered after her because the Duke had not denied their engagement and did not seem interested in doing so tonight. London seemed to have rediscovered Felicity Faircloth, plain, spinster, wallflower, and renamed her, fascinating, a fianced bon vivant. Which she wasn't, of course. She was no different today than she'd been a month ago, except today she was to marry a Duke, supposedly. And her re-entry into society because of that, it wasn't nearly as rewarding as she would have expected. Escaping the crush, Felicity tucked herself behind a potted fern beyond a blessedly open door. All she wished to do was to step over the threshold and flee into the darkness, to hide until it was time to leave. But she couldn't do that, as she still had three dances left on her dance card. Three dances, and none with the Duke of Marwick, who was supposedly her fiancé. At least he hadn't denied the engagement, and he'd sent notice to her father that he would soon come to discuss the details of an impending marriage, which had sent her mother into fits of pleasure and set Arthur to smiling once more. Even Felicity's father had grunted his pleasure at the turn of events, and the Marquis of Bumble rarely had time for domestic matters, let alone time for articulating his pleasure with them. No one seemed concerned that the Duke had not thought it necessary to darken Felicity's doorstep at any point. "Surely he'll turn up eventually," her mother had replied, when Felicity had pointed out the odd progression of events and her alleged fiancé's invisibility. "Perhaps he's simply busy." Felicity rather thought that a man who had time to send correspondence relating to an engagement would find the time to set the thing in motion. But that seemed beside the point. All that, and Devil had promised her that the dress she wore would lure the Duke, would put him in her path and help to win him. But so far there had been no inkling of such a triumph. She wasn't even certain the Duke was in attendance. Was it possible he'd left London altogether? And if so, what was Felicity to do? Continue to brazen it through and lie to all the world? At some point, the Duke of Marwick would have to realize that they were not, in fact, engaged. And no frock, sent by the devil or otherwise, was magic enough to protect her from the truth, once she had to stare down the Duke of Marwick himself. Not even this frock, which seemed more magical than any she'd ever imagined. It was perfect. How he'd done it was a mystery, but he'd promised her a perfectly fitted dress, and one had arrived that morning, as though crafted by magical beings. It had been crafted, in fact, by Madame Hébert, London's most renowned modiste, despite Felicity not having been to the dressmaker in months. The product, she now realized, of her family's penny-pinching, as much as her own disinterest in frocks, now that she wasn't welcome at the center of this world. It seemed, however, that Hébert knew what kind of gown would be of interest, and it was a most definitely interesting one, Felicity had to admit. Even if Arthur's brows hadn't shot up when she'd appeared in it, Felicity had known the moment she'd opened the great white box, embossed with a gold H, that it was going to be the most beautiful gown she'd ever worn. It hadn't been a dress alone, however. There had been shoes and stockings and gloves and undergarments. She blushed at the memory of them, each piece edged with ribbons in a pink so vibrant it seemed scandalous. "I like pink," she told him earlier in the week. It felt sinful to wear those underthings, silk and satin and stunning, knowing they came from him. Nearly as sinful as wearing the dress itself, because she hadn't been able to stop herself from thinking of wearing it for the man who had sent it, rather than for all the men who had seen it tonight. She'd even left the door to her balcony open all day, thinking perhaps he would sneak in once more, that he might wish to see her in it, that he might wish to see that she looked something like pretty in it. But he hadn't come. He'd kissed her in the darkness, giving her a taste of wickedness and sin, tempting her with its power, promised to see her in 3 nights' time, and then deserted her. It wasn't as though a man who lived in Covent Garden and carried a weapon in his walking stick had been invited to a ball hosted by one of the longest-standing titles in Britain. Even if Felicity wished it so. "He didn't come, the bastard," she whispered to herself in the inky blackness beyond.
"Such language, Felicity Faircloth."
Her heart began to pound as she spun around to face him. "Are you an actual devil? Have I summoned you with my thoughts?" His lips twisted in a wry smile.
"Have you been thinking of me?"
Her mouth dropped open. She'd had too much champagne if she was admitting that. "No." The smile became a wolfish grin, and he backed away into the shadows.
"Liar. I heard you, my talkative wallflower. I heard you curse my not coming. Was I expected in your rooms?"
She blushed, grateful for the darkness. "Of course not. I keep my doors locked, now."
"It's a shame I don't know a lockpick, then."
She coughed, and he laughed, low and dark and delicious.
"Come into the darkness, Felicity, lest you be caught cavorting with the enemy."
Her brows knit together, but she followed him nonetheless. "Are you the enemy?" He rounded the corner, where the light from the ballroom gave way to dark.
"Only to everyone in Mayfair."
She drew closer to the shadow of him, wishing she could see his face. "Why is that?"
"I am all they fear," he said, low and dark. "Everyone has a sin, and my trick is knowing it. I can read them on people."
"What is mine?" she whispered, her heart pounding, at once eager to hear his answer and terrified of it. He shook his head.
"Tonight you are too aflame for sin, Felicity Faircloth. You've burned it all away."
She smiled, the words making her breathless.
"And so tell me, have you re-entered the aristocratic fold?"
She spread her hands wide. "Wallflower no more."
"Pity," he said.
"No one wants to be a wallflower," she said.
"I've always thought the wallflowers the best in the hothouse," he replied. "But tell me, my potted orchid, which moths have you lured?"
She wrinkled her nose. "You are mixing metaphors."
"Careful, your wallflower past is showing. No darling of the ton would ever dream of criticizing a man's grammar."
"No darling of the ton would ever dream of clandestinely meeting a man like you." His lips pressed together in a firm line, and for a moment she felt a pang of guilt at the words, before he leaned back against the side of the house.
"Tell me about the incident in the bedchamber."
She went still. It shouldn't be a surprise that he knew about it. Everyone knew about it. But he didn't know about the other scandals in her life, so why would he know about this one? Why did he have to know about this one? She swallowed. "Which incident?"
"The one that made you a woman of questionable eligibility."
She winced at the description. "How did you know about that?"
"You will find, my lady, that there are few things about which I do not know."
She sighed. "There's nothing to be said. There was a ball, and I found myself in a man's bedchamber by accident."
"By accident?"
"Mostly," she hedged. He watched her for a long moment, and then asked,
"Did he touch you?"
The question surprised her. "No, he... In fact, he was quite outraged to discover me there, which I suppose I should be grateful for, as if he hadn't been, I might have..." She stopped and tried again. "I'm not the world's greatest beauty to begin with, and to add to it..." She stopped.
"What?"
"Nothing."
"I don't think that's true."
She sighed again. "I was crying." A beat.
"In a stranger's bedchamber."
"Might we be finished with this conversation?"
"No. Tell me why you were crying."
There was an edge to his voice that she hadn't noticed before. "I'd rather not."
Need I remind you that you owe me for that pretty frock, Felicity Faircloth?
I was under the impression that the frock was part and parcel with our original arrangement.
Not if you're not going to tell me why you were crying it isn't.
He was an irritating man. I'd rather not tell you because it's silly.
I don't mind, silly.
She couldn't help the laughter that came at the words. Excuse me, but you seem to be the kind of person who minds silly exceedingly.
Tell me.
I was part of a group. I had friends.
The vipers from the other night.
She shrugged. I thought they were my friends.
They weren't.
Yes, well, you weren't there to tell me that, so... She paused. At any rate, that was why I was... in a state. We'd been inseparable, and then... She paused, resisting the knot of emotion that came whenever she thought of that time, when she'd been a society darling, and the world had seemed to bend to her will. Like that, we were not. They still sparkled and glittered and loved each other, but they did not love me, and I did not know why. He watched her for a long time.
Friendship is not always what we think. If we are not careful, it often becomes what others desire.
She looked to him. You don't seem the kind of man who loses friends. He raised a brow.
I think you mean that I don't seem the kind of man who has them to begin with.
Do you?
I have a brother and a sister.
I should like to be your friend. The confession shocked them both, and she wished she could take it back. Even more so when he replied,
Felicity Faircloth, I'm no kind of friend for you.
He wasn't wrong, but it smarted nonetheless.
Shall I tell you why your so-called friends left you?
How would you know?
Because I'm a man of the world, and I know how it turns.
She believed him. Why?
They deserted you because you were no longer useful. You stopped laughing at their idiot jests, or stopped simpering after their faded frocks, or stopped encouraging the cruelty they directed at everyone else. Whatever it was, you did something to make them realize you were no longer interested in licking their boots. And there is nothing like the loss of a sycophant to anger gas bags like those for.
She hated the reasoning, even as she knew it was correct. Even as he added,
Every man and woman inside that room is a parasite. Fork, Natasha Corkwood, and Lord and Lady Hagen included. And you are best rid of them, my pretty flame.
At the words, she looked back into the ballroom, watching scores of revelers chatter and gossip and dance and laugh. They were her people, were they not? That was her world, wasn't it? And even if she'd had the same thought earlier, though not in so many words, she should defend her world to this man, this outsider, she supposed. Not all aristocrats are parasitic.
No.
I am not. He came off the wall then, rising to his full height, and she tilted her face up to meet his gaze.
No. You're just so very desperate to be part of it again, that you're willing to make a deal with the devil to do it.
What if I changed my mind? She resisted the whisper of a thought. I need to save my family, she whispered, her cheeks blazing. I don't have a choice.
Ah, yes, familial loyalty. That is admirable, but it seems to me that they could have told you their situation before throwing you to the marriage-seeking wolves.
She hated him a little then, hated him for speaking the words that she barely dared think. I shan't be a bad wife.
I never said you would be.
I will keep his house and provide him heirs. His gaze found hers instantly, hot and focused in the darkness.
Is that the dream, then, mothering the next Duke of Marwick?
Felicity considered the question for a long moment. I've never had aspirations to ducal motherhood, but I should like children, yes. I think I would make a fine mother.
You would.
He looked away, cleared his throat.
But that's not the only dream, is it?
She hesitated, the soft question swirling around them, the secrets it seemed to understand, the desire to be accepted by these people, to take a place among them again. I don't wish to be alone any longer. He nodded.
What else?
I wish to be wanted. The truth hurt as it emerged, leaving an ache in her throat. He nodded.
That's why you lied at the start.
And why I agreed to our deal, she said softly. I want it all. I told you. So much more than I can have.
You are worth all of them combined, he said. But hearing it from me is not enough, is it?
It was more than he knew, it seemed, from the warmth that spread through her at the words. And yet it wasn't enough. You don't know what it was like, what it is like. He watched her for a long moment.
As a matter of fact, my lady, I know precisely what it is like to lose people you think you can rely upon, to be betrayed by them.
She considered the words and what she knew of this strange, wicked man's life, the kind where betrayal might live behind every corner. She nodded.
It does not matter, does it? None of the men I've danced with care for me. There's no reason to believe the Duke shall.
They seemed to care for you when they swarmed you to hold your fan for whatever reason.
She reached for the item in question, spreading it out to show the names written on each of the pine sticks there.
Dance card. And they only care for me because they think I'm to be a...
You have an unclaimed dance.
He had the fan in hand, and she was tethered to him. Her breath caught as he tugged on it, pulling her a step closer.
I thought I should save one for my fictional fiancé.
She paused.
Not so fictional if you read my father's correspondence.
How did you do it?
Magic, he replied,
the scar down the side of his face white in the shadows.
As I promised.
She started to press him for a better answer, but he continued, refusing to let her speak.
You shall claim that dance soon enough.
Her attention lingered on the empty slat in the fan, the way it seemed to shout her falsehood to the world. For a single wild moment, she wondered what it might be like if Devil claimed it. She wondered what might happen if he wrote his blasphemous name across it in black pencil. What might happen if he stepped into the ballroom with her, took her into his arms, and danced her across the room? Of course, a man like Devil did not know how to dance like the aristocracy. He could only watch from the shadows. The thought inspired her.
Wait, have you been watching me all evening?
No.
It was her turn to say.
Liar.
He hesitated, and she would have given anything to see his face.
I had to be certain you wore the dress.
Of course I wore the dress, she said. It's the most beautiful dress I've ever seen. I wish I could wear it every day.
Though I still do not understand how you were able to get it. Madame Hébert takes weeks to produce a design. Longer.
Hébert, like most businesswomen, is willing to work quickly for a premium.
He paused.
That, and she seems to like you.
Felicity warmed at the words.
She made my wedding trousseau.
Or, rather, all the clothes I brought with me to win myself a husband last summer. She paused. To lose myself one, I suppose.
A beat, and then...
Well, without those you would not have this gown, and that would be a proper crime.
She blushed at the words, the most perfect thing anyone could have said.
Thank you.
The Duke could not keep his eyes from you, he replied. Her jaw dropped,
and she looked over her shoulder.
He saw me.
He did.
And what now?
Now, he said. He comes for you.
She swallowed at the promise in the words, at the vision they invoked, of a different man coming for her. No kind of Duke.
How do you know?
Because he shan't be able to resist with the way you look in that gown.
Her heart pounded. And how do I look? The question surprised her with its impropriety, and she nearly took it back. Might have, if he hadn't replied.
Are you searching for compliments, my lady?
She dipped her head at the soft question.
Perhaps.
You look just as you should, Felicity Faircloth, the fairest of them all.
Her cheeks blazed. Thank you for saying so. For the gown, she hesitated. And the other things. He shifted in the darkness, and she was keenly aware of this secret spot, so close to all the world and somehow private for them alone. She didn't know what one was to say after thanking a virtual stranger for undergarments.
My apologies. I'm sure we should not be discussing those.
Never apologize for discussing those.
Another pause, and then he said, wicked and soft,
Are they pink?
Her mouth dropped open. I don't think I should tell you that. He did not seem to care.
You like pink?
She'd never been so grateful for the shadows in her life. I do.
And so, are they?
Yes. She could barely hear the whispered word.
Good.
The word came on a ragged growl, and she wondered if it was possible that he was as moved by the conversation as she was. She wondered if he had thought of her wearing the clothes he'd sent, half as much as she had thought of wearing them for him, of him kissing her in them. Men seemed to like the line, she said, her satin-covered fingers running along the edge of the gown, even as she knew she shouldn't draw attention to it, even as she wanted him to notice it. What did this man do to her? Magic. My mother thought it was unsuccessful. Immodest was the word the Marchioness of Bumble had used before insisting Felicity fetch a cloak immediately.
Your mother is far too old and far too female to be able to judge the success or failure of that frock. How did you explain its arrival?
I lied, she confessed, feeling as though it were a thing she should whisper. I said it was a gift from my acquaintance, Cecily. She's quite scandalous.
Cecily Talbot.
You know her? Of course he did. He was a red-blooded human male, and Cecily was every man's dream. Felicity did not like the thread of jealousy that coursed through her with the thoughts.
The Singing Sparrow is two streets from my offices. It's owned by an acquaintance of hers.
Oh, relief flared. He didn't know Cecily. At least, not in the biblical sense. Not that it mattered whom he knew biblically. Felicity didn't care. Obviously, it had nothing to do with her. At any rate, she said, the dress is beautiful, and I've never felt so close to beautiful in my life as I do wearing it. The confession was soft and honest, and easy, because she spoke it to his silhouette.
Shall I tell you something, Felicity Faircloth? He said softly, taking a step toward her.
The words wrapped around them, making Felicity ache.
Shall I give you a piece of advice that will help you lure your moth?
Will it lure you? She bit back the question. She did not want to lure him. The darkness was addling her brain, and whatever his answer was, that way lay danger. I think I should go, she said, turning away. My mother.
Wait, he said sharply.
And then he touched her. His hand came to hers, and she would have given anything to have her golden glove disappear. Just once, just to feel his touch. She turned back to him, and he moved into the light, taking care that they were not able to be seen. She could see his face now, the strength of it, the slash of scar down his cheek, his amber gaze gone black in the darkness, searching hers before he raised his hand to her face, running a thumb along her jaw, across her cheek, his silver ring a cool counter to the warmth of his skin. More, she wanted to say. Don't stop. He was so close, his eyes raking across her face, taking in all her flaws, discovering all her secrets.
You are beautiful, Felicity Faircloth, he whispered,
and she could feel the breath of the words on her lips. The memory of their kiss on the streets of Covent Garden rioted through her, along with the aching frustration he'd left her with that night, the way she dreamed of him repeating it. He was so close. If she went up onto her toes, he might. Before she could, he let her go, leaving her wanting it.
wanting him. No, she said, hot embarrassment flaring in the wake of the exclamation. She shouldn't have said it. But didn't he want to kiss her again? Apparently not. He took a step back, the irritating man.
Your Duke shall find you tonight, my lady.
Frustration flared. He is not my Duke, she snapped. In fact, I think he might be closer to yours. He watched her for a long moment before saying softly,
You can win every one of them, any one of them, the aristocratic moth of your choosing, and you choose your Duke the moment you pronounced him yours. When he is drawn to you tonight, you shall begin to win him.
And if I do not want him, if I do not want any aristocratic moth, if I want a moth who belongs nowhere near Mayfair? She didn't say the words, instead saying, How shall I win him? He did not hesitate.
Just as you are.
It was nonsense, but he did not seem to care.
Good night, my lady.
And then he was moving, returning to the shadows where he belonged. She followed him to the top of the stone steps leading down to the gardens beyond the house. Wait, she called, searching for something to return him to her. You promised to help. You promised magic, devil. He turned back at the bottom of the steps, white teeth flashing in the shadows.
You have it already, my lady.
I don't have magic. I have a beautiful gown. The rest of me is entirely the same. You've sent a hog to the milliner. It's a lovely hat, but the pig remains. He chuckled in the darkness, and she was irritated that she couldn't see the smile that came with the sound. He didn't smile enough.
You're not a hog, Felicity Faircloth.
With that, he disappeared, and she went to the railing, setting her hands to the cool stone to watch the gardens, angry and frustrated, and wondering what would happen if she followed him. Wanting to follow him, knowing she couldn't, that she had made her bed, and if she or her family had any chance of surviving it, she must lie in it, behatted swine or not. Damn it, devil, she whispered into the darkness, unable to see him and still somehow knowing he was there. How?
When he asks about you, tell him the truth.
That's the worst idea I've ever heard. He didn't reply. He'd placed her in full view of London, promised her a match for the ages, and left her alone with terrible advice and without making good on the promise, as though she were the flame he'd assured her she'd be. Except she wasn't. This is the worst mistake ever made. In history, she said to herself and the knight. This is up there with accepting the gift of a Trojan horse.
Are you giving a lecture on Greek mythology?
She spun around at the words and found the Duke of Marwick standing not 3 feet from her. Chapter 12. Because she wasn't entirely certain what one was to say to a man whom one had proclaimed her fiancé, Felicity settled on. Hello? She winced at the decidedly unmagical word. His gaze flickered to the dark gardens where Devil had disappeared, then back to her.
Hello?
She blinked. Hello? Oh, yes, this is all going quite well. She was all flame. Good God. It was only a matter of time before he ran back to the ballroom, stopped the orchestra, and denounced her publicly. But the Duke did not run. Instead, he took a step toward her, and she pressed back to the stone balustrade. He stopped.
Am I interrupting something?
No, she said altogether too forcefully. Not at all. I was just here, breathing. His brows rose at the words, and she shook her head. Breathing air. Taking air. I mean, it's quite warm in the ballroom, don't you think? She waved a hand at her neck. Very warm. She cleared her throat. Hot. His gaze slid to her wrist.
It was good foresight for you to bring something to combat it.
She looked down at the wooden fan dangling from her wrist. Oh. She snapped it open and fanned herself like a madwoman. Yes, of course. Well, I have excellent foresight. Stop talking, Felicity.
Her brows rose again.
Do you?
Her brows narrowed. I do.
I only ask because it seems to me that someone uninformed of that particular quality might find you to have the opposite of foresight.
She caught herself before her jaw dropped open. How is that? He did not immediately reply, instead coming to stand next to her at the balcony railing, turning his back to the gardens, crossing his arms over his chest and watching the revelers inside the beautifully lit ballroom. The light made his fair hair gleam gold as it harshened the angles of his face, high cheekbones and strong jaw. Something about him whispered familiarity, though she couldn't place it.
After a long silence, he said, "One might argue that telling the world you are engaged to a duke when you've never met him lacks foresight."
And like that, the truth of her act between them. Felicity was not riddled with the embarrassment or the shame she might have imagined. Instead, she was consumed with an immense relief, something near to power, close to the way she felt when she picked a lock, as though the past was behind her and what was to come was all possibility. Which was, of course, a kind of madness in itself, because this man held her fate and that of her family in his hands, and the future he might mete out was dangerous indeed. Madness seemed to reign, nonetheless.
Why did you confirm it? Why did you say it?
I was angry, she said quietly. She lifted a shoulder. It's not a good excuse, I know, but there it is.
It's an honest excuse, he said, returning his attention to the ballroom. I, too, have been angry.
Did your anger result in tacit engagements to a person you'd never met? He looked to her, and it was as though he was seeing her for the first time.
You remind me of someone.
The change of topic was jarring. I do.
She would have adored that dress. I promised to keep her in spools of gold thread someday.
Did you deliver on that promise? His lips flattened into a cold, straight line.
I did not.
I am sorry for that.
As am I.
He shook his head as though to rid himself of a memory.
She is gone now. And I find myself in need of an heir, too.
Felicity could not help her little huff of surprised laughter. I say, you've come to the right place, Your Grace, as there's nothing London likes more than a duke in your precise predicament. He met her gaze, and that eerie familiarity echoed.
If we are to be engaged, you ought to understand my purpose.
Are we to be engaged?
Aren't we? Did you not make that decision 5 nights ago at my home?
Well, I wouldn't call it a decision, she said softly.
What would you call it?
The question didn't seem relevant, so instead Felicity asked. How did he convince you? He looked to her.
Oh.
As I've said, you could have denied me and chosen another without hesitation. What did he threaten you with to make you choose me? She didn't think Devil the kind of man who would threaten bodily harm, but she supposed she didn't really know him. And he had climbed her trellis and entered her bedchamber uninvited, so perhaps he had less of a conscience than she thought.
What makes you think I had to be threatened?
The Duke was an excellent actor, clearly. Felicity almost believed that Devil hadn't convinced him to marry her. Almost. And then said,
I accepted your proposal, did I not?
But why? We've never met.
We met several minutes ago.
She blinked. Are you mad? It was an honest question.
Are you? He countered.
Felicity supposed that was fair. No. He shrugged one shoulder.
Then perhaps I'm not either.
You don't know me. He looked to her.
You would be surprised by what I know of you, Felicity Faircloth.
A thread of unease passed through her at the way he said her name, an echo of another man. The fairest of them all. I'm sure I would, Your Grace, as I am surprised you're even aware of my existence.
I wasn't, honestly, until late in the evening on the night of my ball, and a half-dozen doyens of the temps, none of whom I knew existed either, by the way, waylaid me on the way to the water closet to confirm my engagement to... What was it they called you? Poor Felicity Faircloth. It seemed they wanted to be certain I knew precisely what sort of cow I was purchasing.
Hog, she corrected. immediately regretting the words. He looked to her.
I'm not certain that's more flattering, but if you prefer it.
Before she could tell him, she was not enthralled by either descriptor. He pressed on.
The point is, I narrowly escaped the gaggle of women and then the ball. I should thank you for that.
She blinked. You should.
Indeed. You see, I no longer had need of it, as my work had been done for me.
And which work is that?
The work of finding a wife.
And an heir, she said. He lifted a shoulder, dropped it.
Precisely.
And you thought a madwoman who pronounced you her fiancé was a sound choice for the mother of your future children? He did not smile.
Many would say a madwoman is my best match.
She nodded. Are you a madman, then? He watched her for a long moment, until she thought he was not going to speak again. And then...
Here is what I know of you, finished Felicity. I know you were once a perfectly viable option for marriage. Daughter to a marquis, sister to an earl. I know something happened that landed you in the bedchamber of a man to whom you were not married, and who refused to marry you.
It wasn't what you... She felt she had to explain.
I don't care, he said, and she believed him. The point is, after that, you became more and more curious, an oddity on the edges of ballrooms. And then your father and brother lost a fortune, and you became their only hope. Unbeknownst to you, they took your freedom from you, and shipped you off to, do I have this right, vie in a competition for a married duke's hand?
Yes, she said, cheeks blazing.
That sounds like a plot to a ridiculous romantic novel.
It wasn't ridiculous, and it was terribly romantic for the woman already married to the duke.
He said. So, I have it all right, impoverished spinster wallflower.
Felicity rather hated to be boiled down to three unflattering words, but... Yes, you have it right, except for the bit where I proclaimed to be a fiance to a duke whom I had never met.
Ah, yes, I had nearly forgotten that.
The words weren't dry, they were honest, as though he'd forgotten why they were conversing altogether. He might be mad. Felicity pressed on. I'm sorry, Your Grace, but why on earth would you, a young, handsome duke with a clear past, choose to remain a fiance to me?
Are you trying to convince me not to remain a fiance to you?
Was she? Of course she wasn't. He was, after all, a young, handsome duke with a clear past, was he not? She'd falsely proclaimed him her fiancé, plunging herself and her family into certain social and financial ruin, and here he was, offering her rescue.
I promised you the impossible, did I not?
For a strange, wild moment, it occurred to Felicity that it was not the Duke offering rescue at all. It was the devil, with his outrageous offers and his wild deals and his wicked deeds. A ducal moth, straight to her flame. And here it was. Magic.
But why?
He looked away then, turning back to the dark gardens, his gaze searching, as hers had done before he'd appeared.
What do they call it? A marriage of convenience.
The words settled between them, simple and unsatisfying. Of course, the offer of a marriage of convenience should have sent Felicity into convulsions of pleasure. It meant she'd save her family's reputation and her own. It meant money in her father's coffers, the restoration of the estate, the protection of the name. And that was all before she became a duchess, powerful in her own right, welcome once more in the bright, glittering ballrooms of London. No longer strange or scandalous, but valued. Returned to the place she'd been before, plain but empowered, Duchess of Marwick. It was all she'd ever wanted. Well, not all, but much. Some.
Lady Felicity, the Duke prompted once more, pulling her from her thoughts.
She looked up at him. A marriage of convenience. You get an heir.
And you get a very rich duke. I'm told that's a precious commodity.
He said it as though he'd just learned the fact earlier that day, as though all of recorded history hadn't been predicated on women being forced to find wealthy matches. Her mother would be beside herself with pleasure.
What say you? He prompted.
She shook her head. Was it possible it was so simple?
A single meeting and her lie made true. Her gaze narrowed on the Duke. Why, she repeated, when you could have any of them. She waved a hand at the open door to the ballroom, where no less than a half dozen women openly watched them, waiting for Felicity to misstep and for the Duke to realize his mistake. Frustration flared, alongside that familiar indignation, the emotion that had set this insanity in motion. She resisted it as his gaze followed hers, lingering on prettier, younger, more entertaining unmarrieds, considering them. When he turned back to her, she expected him to have realized that she was not the most qualified bride for him. She was already imagining the disappointment in her mother's eyes when this false engagement was no longer. She was already scrambling for a solution to Arthur's empty coffers, to those of her father. Perhaps she could convince the Duke to break off the engagement without revealing her stupid mistake. He did not seem a bad man. He simply seemed, well, frankly, he seemed uncommon. Except he did not break off the engagement as she'd expected. Instead, his eyes met hers, and for the first time it seemed as though he saw her. And for the first time she saw him, cool and calm, not at all unsettled by the fact that she was there and they were about to be engaged. He seemed not to care at all, actually.
I don't want them. You turned up at the right time, so why not you?
It was ridiculous. Ducal marriages did not happen like this. Marriages in general did not happen like this. On empty balconies with no more than a vague whim born of convenience. And yet, this was happening. She'd done it. No devil had done it, like magic. The words whispered through her, at once true and terribly false. Devil hadn't worked magic. This Duke was no moth. Felicity was not flame. She was convenient. And there was nothing magical about convenience.
Have you room on that fan for another dance? The Duke said, interrupting the rush of awareness that flooded her at the thought.
She looked down at the fan, at the empty slat that remained. An echo came from earlier, a vague imagining of another man marking that slat, claiming that dance, a man who disappeared into the darkness, replaced with this one, who reigned in the light. She tried a smile. I do have room, as a matter of fact. He reached for the fan, stopping before he touched it, waiting for her to offer it to him. Devil hadn't waited. Devil wouldn't have waited. She extended her hand to the Duke, and he lifted the fan, taking the little pencil dangling from it in hand, and writing his name across the bare stick. Marwick. Felicity imagined she should feel breathless at the action, but she didn't. Not even when he released the fan and claimed her hand instead, lifting it in a slow, deliberate motion, until his full, handsome lips grazed over her knuckles. She most definitely should have felt breathless at that. But she was not, and neither was he. And as she watched the Duke of Marwick, her proclaimed fiancé turned real, lift his head, a single thought rioted through her. The Duke's wings remained unsinged, which meant the devil had not made good on his deal. Chapter 13. Devil was already spoiling for a fight the next night when he stepped through the well-guarded door to the bastard's warehouse, so much so that the sound of the lock turning in the great slab of steel did not comfort him the way it should have. He'd spent much of the day attempting to focus on his ledgers, telling himself that it was more important than everything else, that he had plenty of time to seek out Felicity Faircloth and discover precisely what had happened between her and Ewan. In fact, he knew what had happened. His watch had seen her home only 2 hours after he left her, along with her mother deposited there by her brother, after which no one had left Bumble House, not through any of the ground-level egresses, nor down the trellis beyond Felicity's bedchamber. This morning, the ladies of the house had spent the morning in Hyde Park with the Marchioness's dogs, and returned for luncheon and tea and note-writing, or whatever it was that ladies did in the afternoons. Absolutely nothing out of the ordinary had come to pass, except Felicity had met Ewan. Devil had watched from the shadows as they'd spoken, resisting the instinct to go to her and stop their conversation. And then Ewan had kissed her, on her gloved hand, but kissed her nonetheless. And Devil had gone stone still and somehow turned his back on the scene, rather than giving in to his second baser instinct, which was to destroy the Duke, carry Felicity off to Covent Garden, lay her down, and finish the kiss they'd started the last time she was there. But she wasn't for him. Not yet. Not until it was time to thieve her away from his brother and remind him of how easily he could be raised up, only to be dropped hard and fast to the ground, ensuring Ewan never again considered flying too fast or too far. That was why Devil had been so kind to her, so complimentary, because Felicity Faircloth was a means to a very specific end. Not because he actually thought she was beautiful, not because he actually cared if she was wearing pink undergarments, not because he actually wished her to believe in her own worth. He didn't. He couldn't. And so he told himself that it was nothing more than general curiosity that sent him to the warehouse, to find Whit in shirt sleeves, hook in hand, overseeing the distribution of the shipment that had been sitting in the ice hold for more than a week, waiting to move. General curiosity in the business, and not the memory of Ewan's lips on Felicity's knuckles. Not remotely. After all, Devil told himself, a smuggling empire did not run itself, and there were workers to be paid and deals to be inked, and a new shipment to arrive next week, laden with liquor and contraband, which they wouldn't have room for if they didn't get rid of the one in the hold. General curiosity, and not a keen need to resist the urge to go to the Faircloth home this afternoon, climb the damn trellis and talk to the girl. He was a businessman. What mattered was the work. Inside the warehouse, 2 dozen strong men moved in unison, muscles straining under the weight of the crates they passed from down the line, from the hole in the floorboards to one of 5 caravans, ready to move the product overland, 2 to a score of locations in London, 1 west to Bristol, 1 north to York, and the last to the Scottish border, where it would be redistributed for delivery into Edinburgh and throughout the Highlands. There were any number of moments in the life of a smuggler that brought danger and uncertainty, but these were the worst, knowing that once the goods left the warehouse, the transport was in more danger than ever. No one could prove the bare-knuckle bastards were smuggling goods inside the ice ships they worked. There was no way to check the contents of the ships as they entered the harbour, nearly sinking for all the melted ice in their holds. In this moment, however, with untaxed, undeclared goods in the hands of their loyal men, no one would be able to deny the criminal activity. On nights when they moved product, every able body in the organisation helped to get it done as quickly as possible. The longer night hung over the rookery, the safer the product, and all their futures. Devil made for Whit and Nick, shucking his coat and waistcoat, exchanging his walking stick for a great, curving box hook. He moved to the hole, coming alongside Whit, heaving crates up and passing them to another man, then another and another, and a second row of men immediately followed him, forming a new line, doubling the pace of the work. Nick was down in the hole, marking boxes and barrels with white chalk as they passed, calling out their destinations and marking them into the small ledger that never left her pocket.
St. James's, Fleet Street, Edinburgh, York, Bristol.
It wasn't the business of smuggling that made for salacious news. Crates of contraband weren't interesting until they were opened and used. But the purchasers of those crates, the most powerful men in government, religion, and media, suffice to say, the world would be eager for even a glance at the bare-knuckle bastard's client list. Devil hooked a barrel of bourbon headed to York Cathedral and lifted it up with a loud grunt.
Christ, those things are heavy.
Whit didn't hesitate in pulling up a crate, his heavy breathing the only indication that the grueling task was impacting him.
Weakling.
Nick snorted a little laugh, but did not look away from her list. Devil reached down for the next box, ignoring the way the muscles of his shoulders strained when he pulled it up and passed it to the man at his back. He returned his attention to Nick.
I'll have you know that I'm the intelligent brother.
She looked up at him, eyes twinkling.
Are you?
She marked a box.
Bank of London.
Whit grunted and leaned into the hole.
And the books he insisted on reading when we were children continued to keep him warm at night. Oi, Devil said, hooking another barrel. Without those books, I'd never have learned about the Trojan horse, and then where would we be?
Wit didn't hesitate.
I imagine we would have had to devise for ourselves that we could smuggle one thing inside another thing. However would we have done that? He asked with a little grunt as he poured up a cask of brandy. Thank goodness for your primitive knowledge of the Greeks.
Devil took advantage of his empty hook and offered a rude gesture to his brother, who turned to the men assembled with a wide white grin and said,
You see, proof I am right.
Wit looked back to Devil and added,
No, not at all a sign of intelligence one might point out. What happened to you being the brother who does not talk? I'm feeling out of sorts today.
Wit heaved up a heavy crate.
What brings you out, bruv? I thought I'd check on the shipment. I'd have thought you had other things to check on tonight.
Devil gritted his teeth and reached down for a crate of playing cards.
What's that to mean?
Wit didn't reply. Devil straightened.
Well?
Wit shrugged a shoulder beneath his sweat-dampened shirt.
Only that you've your master plan to see to, no?
What's master plan? The ever-curious Nick asked from below. If you lot are planning something without me...
We're not planning anything.
Wit reached back into the hole.
It's just Dev.
Nick's keen blue gaze moved from one brother to the next.
Is it a good plan?
It's a shit plan, actually, Wit said.
Unease threaded through Devil, and his retort stuck in his throat. It was a good plan. It was the kind of plan that punished Ewan and Felicity. There was only one way to respond, another rude gesture. Wit and Nick laughed, before she interjected from her place below.
Well, as much as I'm loath to end this fascinating conversation, that's the last of it.
Devil turned to watch the men on the line tuck the last of the product into the large steel wagons as Wit nodded down and said,
All right, then. Tell the lads to send up the ice.
Passing his hook down to Nick, Devil received another, cold as the product it held, the first of the 6 stone blocks of ice. Turning, he passed the hook and its capture to the next man in line, who handed him an empty hook, which Devil passed down to catch its frozen prey. The second block was passed up, and Devil passed down another empty hook, and so it went, rhythmic and backbreaking, until the backs of the steel caravans were filled to the roof with blocks of ice. There was a pleasure in the grueling work, in the line of men working in unison toward a common, achievable goal. Most goals were not so easily reached, and too often, those who aspired to them found themselves disappointed in the reaching. Not this. There was nothing so satisfying as turning to discover the work finished well, and the time ripe for an ale. But there was no satisfaction to be had that day. He was reaching down into the hole when John shouted out for him. Turning, he found the big man crossing from the back entrance to the warehouse, a boy trailing behind him. Devil's gaze narrowed in recognition. Brixton was one of Felicity's watch. He dropped the hook to the dusty floor, unable to keep himself from moving toward them.
What's happened to her?
The boy lifted his chin, strong and proud.
Nothing.
What do you mean, nothing?
Nothing, Devil, Brixton replied. Ladies, right as rain.
Then why are you off your watch?
I weren't, until this stroker pulled me off it.
John cut the boy a warning glance at the insult, and Devil turned to the head of the warehouse's security.
What were you doing in Mayfair?
John shook his head.
I wasn't in Mayfair. I've been on guard outside.
They were moving a shipment tonight, so the roads leaving the rookery were monitored by a team of men in their employ. No one came in or out without the bastard's approval. Devil shook his head. He couldn't have understood. It wasn't possible. He narrowed his gaze on the boy.
Where is she?
At the door.
His heart began to pound.
Whose door?
Yours, John said, finally allowing the smile that had been threatening to break through.
Your lady's trying to pick the lock.
Devil scowled.
She's not my lady, and she sure as hell shouldn't be in the rookery. And yet, here we are.
This from Wit, who had appeared behind Devil.
Are you going to get the girl, Dev, or are you going to leave her out there like a lamb to the slaughter?
God damn it. Devil was already heading for the back door.